This is Defy These Times, and I'm your host, Juri Ayoub. Welcome, everyone. This is Defy These Times. I'm your host, Juri Ayoub, and today we'll be having a rather special episode. It's going to be shorter than usual, and it's going to be about a very specific topic. And technically, it's going to be our first ever fundraising, so that's kind of exciting. We'll be talking about queer mutual aid in Lebanon. And here to talk to us about that today is repeated guest Ayman Makarem. Ayman, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, hello. First of all, thanks for having me. My name is Ayman Makarem. I'm a writer and organizer from Beirut. And I'm a core founder of the group Queer Mutual Aid Lebanon. And we've been working for the last 3 years. And I can tell you more about the actual work we do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So let's just start with that. Like, tell us more about the work you do. Who are you? When were you founded? That sort of thing.
All right. So we actually formed in June 2020. And initially, it was a group that was responding to the lack of political organizing after the COVID lockdowns. Just to give a brief timeline, October 17, 2019, surge of political activity, movements in Lebanon. It's considered a revolution by some and uprisings by others. But then with COVID lockdowns in March, things started to lessen. And so we were finding that obviously our community was suffering, not just by the COVID pandemic, but also the economic collapse. And we, as in just two or three people initially, started realizing that we do need new alternative modes of supporting our community, because otherwise we just have these NGOs, which are very problematic, which I can get into later. And so it started with some discussions about how we can develop new modes of organizing to support our community and also push for key political demands. We met a few times, and then a few months after August 4th, 2020 happens, the Beirut port explosion. And then based on that, we did a big fundraiser because obviously a lot of queer people were affected because they're just people that are in these affected areas. And from this fundraiser, we provided financial aid, especially to cover rent, medical fees, and other types of basic necessities. And since then, we've gotten funding from a few international feminist organizations. We've also done several fundraisers, so it's sort of funded by the community. And essentially, in short, we are a group of, at the moment, about 8 queer individuals in or connected to Lebanon who are working to support the queer and trans communities in Lebanon through direct financial support and other forms of legal, but also political and social support, which is sorely needed. And there are no other groups there are very few other groups that are working at this scale.
Mm. And this ties into, I think the first time you came on this podcast was to talk actually about mutual aid in Lebanon. Can you make that distinction for those who don't know? I'm assuming a good chunk of our listenerships do, but what is this different about mutual aid? Why that framework, basically? And I guess connected to this, since you hinted at it earlier, what is the main problem or problems with the sort of what I think in our spaces we would call kind of like the NGOization of care or care work in general and all of that stuff?
Yeah, so a part of it, theoretically, Arundhati Roy's essay on the NGOization of resistance is very important. But a lot of the people who are in the group at the moment have experience within the NGOs and the NGO industry. And this is definitely something that I would consider has sort of plagued our community. There are some LGBTQ plus organization NGOs in Lebanon that do good work and important work, but ultimately are inhibited by several factors. And so it is good to then describe mutual aid in comparison. So part of the problem with the NGOs are that they replicate the same exact hierarchies that a kind of a social or political movement is aiming to, you know, usurp or dismantle. And so a part of it is that it becomes institutionalized, that people get, it becomes a career supporting the community or doing whatever. But also it's not accountable to that community. The community, they speak on behalf of the community, but very often the community do not get a say in how they use their funds or how their aid is shaped. So one, there are a few big distinctions between mutual aid and charity. And one of them is that it is meant to be, mutual aid is meant to be from and within the community, mm-hmm. from and to the community. And so I do think it's important that we are all within this community that we're trying to support. And secondly, we work very hard to blur the distinction between us who are receiving the funds and those that are, or rather us that are organizing the funds and those that are receiving the aid, and allowing for a lot of reciprocity and accountability and people to communicate to us their needs. And so us to organize our work based on the needs that we're hearing from the community. We also, the frameworks, we work with a lot of other feminist organizations, and our movements that we are aligned with are very much so rooted in anti-capitalism, anti-racism, and anti-patriarchal structures. And that's a key distinction as well. It might sound a bit dogmatic, but the idea is that charity is a band-aid, and it does not seek to dismantle the causes of poverty, of marginalization, of oppression, but almost relies on its existence. So there's a kind of built, it's sort of, it's become its own problem, mm-hmm. the NGOs. It's not just like a band-aid, but it's a band-aid that's become a part of the problem. And so what we're trying to do with the mutual aid group is find a way to support people's immediate needs, rent, medical fees, food, you know, basic essentials to keep people around, essentially, while at the same time not foregoing the larger political struggles of queer liberation, but also feminism as a whole, and of anti-capitalism, because again, a lot of the things that queer people in Lebanon are facing are things like homelessness. And that's a class issue. That is a capitalist issue. The fact that landlords can just change rents, and especially now with the changing currencies in Lebanon, the exchange rate, some landlords are essentially kicking people out of their homes. And so, yeah.
Yeah, it's of course a lot to say here, and I'll try to keep my own thoughts short so I don't turn this into another regular episode. But it is, I think in Lebanon especially, but I guess in a lot of, I don't know, I'm going to say broadly speaking, the global south, but even honestly, I mean, I witnessed this in London as well. Then you have the class differences in London that get kind of reinforced also through these structures. And kind of an interesting point that you sort of also hinted at is that a lot of those of us who would say like, oh, we prefer mutual aid over NGOs or whatnot, to kind of simplify it a bit, are actually pretty familiar with the NGO world. In a lot of cases, at least most, I think maybe everyone that I can think of that kind of has reached the same conclusion that we're sort of arguing for here, have already had some experience in the NGO world or are still in it for various reasons. That you could have very basic, like you need food on the table kind of reasons. Which is actually a lot of the people who also works in NGOs, and not in the top hierarchies, usually in top ranks, but you know, the average person working at the desk job or going on the field, the social worker, that sort of thing. But the kind of interesting thing that happened, interesting and is an unfortunate thing that happens within that world is that, for example, if you're working in an NGO, and this is something I've experienced personally, probably you as well, and a lot of people listening probably as well, and the goal of that NGO is that, well, we are here to, I don't know, tackle poverty or tackle homelessness in Beirut. That the goal at often ends up kind of actually being subsumed into the other priorities within the NGO. So, are we being paid fair enough? Which is all completely fair things to ask and to wonder as well. Is our boss nice or not nice? Do we need to worry about this or that? All of these other questions end up actually coming before the goal of the supposed goal of that NGO, which is, tackling homelessness. And often it's like, what does tackling homelessness mean, right? Because there is the tackling homelessness and there is just making tackling the rent crisis. Those are two different things in the NGO world, although in many ways, of course, they are completely linked. And so there is that element of like charity often, and this has nothing to do with the necessarily with the people within them, but structurally cannot almost by design resolve an issue completely. There has to be some form of problem that continues to exist in one way or another. And this creates obviously all of those other problems. And I think in a situation like ours in Lebanon, and arguably even more so in like, let's say Palestine or Iraq or whatnot, you will often have people who are kind of helicoptered in from different contexts, with decent salaries often compared to locals, and who don't really need to know much and who can just change. I did 6 months, not me, but like, imagine I did 6 months in Amman and I'm using that experience to do 6 months in Cusco in Peru. And then the experience is that you come from someplace nicer, from the in that logic, and you are helping people who are less fortunate. And so it's kind of this bizarre, I don't know, it's a bastardization of care, because wanting to help those who are less fortunate sounds nice. If like on a very basic level, let's say, but of course, helping someone that's less fortunate, I'm using those terms in quotation, people can't see me, is different than actually questioning why are some people more fortunate than others and seeking to completely remove that, abolish that. And then of course we're getting to abolition frameworks. Anyway, so I wasn't gonna talk a lot and here I am.
No, it's very good. It's very important because I
Yeah.
think there is a lot of the distinction of even some of the words we use, right? In terms of like helping people,
Yeah.
as though like sometimes like as though they don't know what they need, you know? And something that we really emphasize is that people know what their needs are. They just do not have access. They do not have resources. They do not have whatever. And so that's why it is so important for this type of work to be fully like responsive to listening to people and not sort of questioning or reporting. I think reporting is a very important distinction here, because a charity is an organization that, let's say, something that's a bit more local in Lebanon, they still have funders from abroad, and those funders are different, whatever. They have priorities, and sometimes they have no idea what the actual context is, and oftentimes you have to, with bigger funders, report and be very specific about the type of work you're doing. So we've been very lucky that a lot of the people we've been working with, for instance, do not need receipts for the payments that we make, and we just basically give people and put money in their pockets. And that's impossible to do a receipt for. And so that increases the limitations of NGOs. And so you imagine that you get a certain big funding from a big grant from a funder, and it's specifically for these things. And you have to make sure all that money is going to these specific things. And so then you end up spending money confirming that the money you're giving is actually being used for what funders in Europe or in the US say they say that it's meant to be for, which is why we are trying to branch out and be more and emphasize more community fundraising, because we can be fully transparent about what we're doing. And we won't be beholden to the desires and the demands of funders. And one last thing, I think there's a lot of criticisms that I have based on readings, but also from my own personal experience, and people within the group have as like people who work or like NGO workers. But and a really important thing is the criticisms of the NGOs that I've heard from so many people that we work with. And because our group is one of the only that like we're trying not to be so Beirut centric, you know, that we're working with people that are in the rural areas, in smaller cities, or in places that, you know, Beirut based NGOs don't really reach out to. And also for, you know, trans women who, I want to be a bit fair here, but essentially we've heard a lot of complaints from trans women about exclusion from the larger sort of LGBTQ NGOs, that, and they sort of feel a lot of a transphobia. So there's an emphasis on especially gay men. And so a lot of our criticisms also come from the community, you know, and we hear constantly how they feel and whatever. And again, a part of it is that they know that they have money and that they've learned these tools to try to get the money from them. They know that they're being exploited by the NGOs, and so they've learned how to exploit the NGOs themselves. And so we often find when we talk to people, the first thing we say, we are not an NGO. We are just a bunch of people who are just in the community and concerned and want to do stuff and whatever. And you can really immediately see the difference in how they approach us and how the conversation goes and the relationships that form. Because NGOs, oftentimes, just by their structure, it's quite unidirectional. It's quite transactional. It's here's $100, fuck off. And, you know, as opposed to what we're trying to do, which is form actual relationships of solidarity with people and like talk to them. And a lot of people are just really fucking lonely. And so that's something that, I don't know, yeah, isn't covered by the sort of strict guidelines of the sort of NGOs currently.
So I want us to get
important.
Yeah, thanks. I want us to get into kind of queer liberation as a political slogan, or, you know, as a political struggle more like. But quickly before doing that, one of the first things for me personally when I, let's say one of the first things that made me question, so even before getting into the academic terms around like NGOization of care work and struggle and resistance and all of that, Roy was indeed one of the first I read, if I remember correctly, was this idea that still baffles me to this day, and I still see it, like friends of mine that works in NGOs and whatnot, of like, let's say they have a $50,000 budget, I don't know, for this project over a certain period of time. I'm going to say 1 year, 2 years, whatever. And often when they reach the limit of that year and there is still, let's say, 5K or 10K or whatnot, the funders sometimes actually tell them, just spend it on whatever and they will have a criteria, because we need to show to our funders or whatnot that this amount has been spent in order to justify sending us the same amount next year or even more amount next year. And so this has translated into something like, and here I'm kind of making up an example, but I mean, listeners would just have to trust me that this is just, this has happened somewhere. Like, this is not out of the, you know, out of the realm of imagination by any stretch. But like, you know, again, imagine an NGO that is whose goal is like, okay, we're going to tackle girls' education between 5 and 10 and make sure that every girl between 5 and 10 years old gets access to this. And we have a team of 10 people. We're funded by, I don't know, the Germans, the German government, or some NGO, whatever. And we know, okay, we need to do this, but we have a certain amount of budget. We're paying the staff as well, the salaries of the people working in that NGO and all of that stuff. And by the end of the financial term, the term of the budgeting term, whatever the fuck it's called, you have 10K left, 15K left. Well, okay, well, if the goal of the NGO is to support girls' education, well, you might think, well, we have 10, 15K extra. We can spend that on the actual school infrastructure, or just literally giving the money to those girls' parents, or buying them the textbooks, or, you know, something very concrete that would say, like, what would clearly prove basically that this money is entirely dedicated to girls' education, right? And that if you want to argue for the NGO structure, you would say, okay, this is a way of having it in an orderly, I don't know what the arguments would be, but I'm imagining, okay, whatever the arguments would be, this is the end result, and here is the proof. Like, we had actually extra money. The money is not for us. Clearly, it's for them. This is the point of what we're doing. But this almost never happens, because structurally, you would have to account for those extra $10,000. And especially if you have to report to a government, for example, and especially if you have to report, let's say you're funded by, I don't know, the British government and you are in Lebanon, you will also have to deal with stuff like, well, you have X amount of money that has been unaccounted for. You have the PREVENT program in the UK. You have to, just in case your money has gone to terrorist activity, you have to, you know, all of that stuff. And you end up like, I've so many NGO folks that I know, workers and whatnot, have gotten so exhausted because most of the time that they actually spend, or a good chunk of it, just go to reporting. Mm-hmm. Reporting what they're doing, writing down what they're doing, sending, you know, what, maybe having a follow-up email and then a follow-up conversation with that person, and then all of that, to the point that's like, it almost doesn't matter what kind of NGO work you do, as in the goal of the NGO, the supposed mission of that NGO, kind of at some point doesn't matter too much, because 90% of the time, slightly exaggerating, of what you're going to do is roughly the same thing regardless of what that mission is. So yeah. Like clean drinking water in Central African Republic, I'm making things up here, and homelessness in Northern Lebanon are the same thing in terms of like your day-to-day work. And that's insane. There's just clearly something's wrong with that model. But anyway.
Well, there's two. I don't want to take too long with this. So I'll just say two little stories that I think really exemplify exactly what you're talking about. I have a friend who's a Palestinian Syrian who I was close with in Beirut. And he told me a story. He was working as a translator in an NGO, I think even in the UN, actually. And he recounted to me a story wherein he would go with a couple UN people to recipients of AIDS house, and in the house report on basically like, so how did you spend this $300 we gave you? And the farcical thing about the story is that my friend tells me, he's like, so we rented the car. My fee was like $100 for that day. This UN guy is definitely getting paid whatever for the day, and this other guy. So all in all, it was like $500 to check up on how $300 was spent. And it's just ridiculous.
Right.
But more so than that, I met this Palestinian woman who works in, who was part of an organization working on like agricultural issues in Palestine. And one thing she talked to me about is that a lot of the funders and places she was getting money from told her, would give you money, but you can't do anything political. And if you know anything about Palestinian agricultural issues, it is deeply, deeply, it's just 100%. Yeah. I mean, you have Zionist settlers like ripping mm-hmm. up fucking whatever, like olive trees that have been there for thousands of years. And so it's kind of, by its structure, limits it. And it's that same exact capitalist logic and the liberal logic of just, I don't know. It's actually contradictory when you re-examine it, but it's just, we definitely need something new. And I think this then leads us to that next point about queer liberation, mm-hmm. because the queer liberation that many people just need will not come from the NGOs. It will not come from the NGOs. There's this fun thing that's been going around, the revolution will not be funded, which is very scary for those of us who have, you know. But exactly, there's this thing that these types of movements and or social or forms of organizing that aims to not just meet the immediate needs, but also to dismantle the structures that are creating those needs. It's very difficult, and each local context will have its own specificities. Mm-hmm. So that's why it sounds like quite dogmatic. And queer liberation, I think, is an interesting slogan, because I think that is what we're talking about. We are talking about liberation from patriarchy, from capitalism, from, I mean, in Lebanon, in sectarianism and all these things, because in many cases, our survival relies on it. And I think it's a really important phrase, especially working within this group, because it's just very clear with a lot of the people that we're meeting, you know, that we would never have met without this group. Mm. You know, people from rural areas or like older trans women who, you know, you're not going to see if you just go to like the gay bar in Beirut or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's a necessity. These things are killing us. capitalism is killing us. And queer liberation, I think, is an important thing. We don't emphasize it too much because it does sound dogmatic, and it's not. It informs our philosophy, but not necessarily our daily work. But that is ultimately something that we're thinking a lot about, and we know that we can't do it alone. And it's something, and this is why obviously it pushes us towards working with other groups and other feminist organizations and other grassroots movements. And why for us mutual aid as a concept is not just a tool that we're using to organize, but something that we're developing and we're experimenting. Because as far as I know, we're one of the only in the country and the region that are explicitly adopting this philosophy and this mode of political organizing, partly because we've seen so many other ones fail, not just the NGOs, but also some of the other forms of sort of political organizing, which oftentimes fall into a lot of vanguardism. Yeah. Or a lot of...
Can you explain that for those who don't know?
Oh, it's just this very condescending thing of just, we are, I think Lenin Marxism, mm-hmm. Marxist-Leninism, this sort of, we know what the people want and we are going to be pushing for the whatever. We have the philosophy and we have the whatever. And it starts becoming very gatekeepy. And it's like me and this four people who have read Kropotkin. Mm-hmm. And this is why mutual aid is interesting, because I've read Kropotkin, I've read anarchists. They're interesting, but there's no handbook. Mm-hmm. It's not even an attempt to be a handbook, because what works for the working class in Russia does not necessarily reflect the needs and the tools and the strategies that queer people in Lebanon mm-hmm. need and should do, mm-hmm. and whatever, and its relation to empire and all these things. And what I'm hoping, and again, queer liberation, and liberation, it's a good word, I think, because it also needs that sense of internationalism. And internationalism and obviously intersectionality, because we're very aware that this isn't an issue just affecting our ability to be ourselves in terms of gender or sexual expression, but our ability to live, to survive. And so intersectionality is a very important concept there when talking about, these communities that are, in the headways or whatever, like at the intersection of class domination and imperialist domination, patriarchal, capitalist, everything. When we're talking about understanding the needs of Syrian refugee trans women in Lebanon, you get a very different understanding of the world you live in, of Lebanon, and I think in order to build a really strong alternative movement, those are exactly the people we need to be talking to and working with.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, yeah, I don't know. Where can people donate? I'm going to include everything, obviously, in the show notes, but yeah.
Okay, cool. So yeah, we've got a Patreon. So in our attempt to become a bit sustainable away from key, like large funders, we're really hoping to get a sort of more sustainable community fund, crowdfunding mm-hmm. For our work. So we have a Patreon. It's at, I think, /QMA Lebanon.
It is. Yeah.
We have a PayPal that's also at QMA Lebanon. We don't have a social media presence yet because we're still working on these ideas of visibility and how whatever. You can reach out to us. So I operate this Instagram page called Biz the Day No. 6. We do political comics, but both of us are involved with the Queer Mutual Aid. And you can reach us through the Patreon as well, because there's messaging mm-hmm. on that platform.
Yeah, cool. And okay, I mean, since I have you, a very last thing, talk about the Unicorn Riot series, just because, why not? Just talk about it.
Great, a new plugin. Okay, so yeah,
new plugin.
So I'm a writer, and lately I've been working on comics with my close best friend, who is also from Lebanon. The series is, so we have a comics series that's hosted by Unicorn Riot, this very cool alternative media organization collective based in the US. And yeah, so we have a comic series with them called Revolution in Every Country. It's a series of comics of revolutions in the Swana region, The first episode was on Syria, the second episode is on the Sudanese revolution, and the third one's on Lebanon. And we have it translated in both English and Arabic. And yeah, we're really interested in looking at sort of things that are usually ignored by people that are reporting on revolutions. And we really wanted to be writing this from a perspective. I was very influenced by this after the Lebanese uprisings. The name actually comes from a chant by intersectional feminists in Lebanon, Thawra bikul bildan, revolution in every country. And that kind of internationalism that I felt from that chant and that I wanted to convey through the series. The fourth episode, which I'm working on now, will be on Iran and the recent revolutionary waves there. Again, because I think there are so many similarities, especially in terms of the power structures that we live under in the Arab world and in whatever. And this is why the word Swana is important for me. And so, yeah, I think the comic is a way of forming those linkages. And so, yeah, you can find it on Unicorn Riot. You can also find the comics on our Instagram page, Vizier number 6. And yeah, thanks for letting me plug that.
Yeah, sure. It's unicornriot.ninja, which is a very funny title, but
Yeah.
they're awesome. They're a really awesome website. Okay, well, Ayman, thank you for doing this.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. 5D's Times is hosted by myself, Joey Ayoub. I am also its producer, researcher, writer, and sound editor. If you want to help turn this project into a full-time job, please head out to patreon.com/firethesetimes to support it. These episodes are part of a bigger project which includes resources, a newsletter, and eventually YouTube video essays as well. As always, thank you for listening and take care.